United States' use of drones is horrific, and it is wrong. First of all, as we've learned through many exposés recently in the media, drones frequently kill the wrong people. But even more importantly, why are we killing people to begin with? The United States should end all drone warfare and should have a major readjustment of its foreign policy priorities, period.
Drones have transformed modern warfare. Unlike manned planes, they can hover over an area for weeks, collecting information ahead of an attack. They can also linger afterward, observing the aftermath of a bombing. Perhaps most critically, they allow the U.S. to kill enemies overseas without risking American lives. But innocent civilians overseas are dying, too. According to new reporting from the New York Times, hundreds more have died from airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan than the Pentagon has officially reported. That follows recent news that no one from the U.S. military would be disciplined for an August drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians. After the break, we'll discuss the impact of the modern use of drones, both on civilians abroad and on U.S. service members, and who should be held accountable when an airstrike kills civilians. I'm Jen White, and you're listening to the 1A Podcast. A reminder to have your questions answered on future topics, or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Senior engineer Eric Mueller shares how his team uses machine learning to organize merchant names and transaction histories, and how this contributes to safer banking.
We take the merchant names, which might be in all caps, and they might even be wrong, and we use machine learning to clean them up. Having clean merchant names is important, really, to help you identify your transactions. So if you see a transaction you don't recognize, you'll know immediately it wasn't your transaction.
To learn more, go to CapitalOne.com/ML.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking about the use of drones and other airstrikes and the impact it has on civilians. Joining us now to discuss her new reporting on drones is investigative journalist Azmat Khan from the New York Times Magazine. She's also currently writing a book about America's air wars. Azmat, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
According to your reporting, the Pentagon says officially that 188 Afghan civilians have been killed by airstrikes since 2018. In Iraq and Syria, the official number is around 1,500. But your investigation found that the actual death tolls were much higher. How much higher?
That's a great question. Several years ago, when I was doing ground reporting in Iraq, I found that the rate of civilian death on the ground that I was calculating from airstrikes in the war against ISIS was 31 times higher than what the government was claiming at the time. To date, what I've been finding is that when outside organizations are the ones who provide the information based on their reporting on the ground, whether that's a reporter or an NGO, the military's assessment, if they accept it, will match that record. But if they don't, if they rely only on their own information to do an assessment, I found that the true rate of civilian death was twice as high. So what we do know in instances of what has been deemed credible, like what they accept, there's already a rate in which they are still not accepting a large enough number of the reality on the ground. But overall, if you were to just do a sample of whether or not they accept something as credible or not and compare it to their overall numbers, you're looking at a rate that's even higher than that.
Now, your reporting included visiting nearly 100 sites of drone strikes across Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. What did you learn from being on the ground in those places?
Right, 100 airstrikes in these places. What I saw was a rate of civilian death and casualty and injury that was much higher than what the government claimed, that many survivors suffered disabilities, that children were, I think, that almost nearly double what the government had calculated about the number of children dying I had found on the ground. But in addition to that, there are these survivors who have no idea why they were targeted and who are really left looking for answers, who often can't afford medical coverage for the debilitating injuries they suffer. And then when I compared sort of what may have gone wrong with against these documents I obtained, right? So I had been seeking to understand the military's own assessments of what it concluded it had happened in these airstrikes that it had carried out, that where there was maybe a report or an allegation of a civilian casualty. So when I would examine that record and compare it to the family on the ground and the reporting I did in that neighborhood, really asking about what was happening at the time and digging deeply into, you know, what the document said and whether it was true, was that oftentimes the military failed to realize when it had misidentified a target. For example, when it thought that, you know, a house full of families was an ISIS headquarters, or, you know, when it saw a particular person, that because of confirmation bias, this idea that military officials or intelligence analysts may really struggle when they've been told something is a target, for example, a car bomb, right? And they're looking for something that's moving in a particular area, may struggle to see that as anything other than a car bomb, even when presented with evidence otherwise. For example, such as the driver of the vehicle getting out of the car and greeting a group of civilians on the sidewalk. Or the fact that the car's description didn't quite match the description of the intelligence tip that came in, that oftentimes in those moments and with that perception of risk and threat, that they can overlook what that target might actually be as a result of that confirmation bias. The thing that honestly surprised me most, I think, the number one recurring problem that I saw or factor involved in a lot of the civilian deaths was that beforehand, they didn't detect civilian presence. They had a conclusion that there was no civilian presence at that target, or they did a collateral scan, which was maybe sometimes it could just be a few seconds of looking over the area. Sometimes it was longer. But in nearly three quarters of the casualties I documented on the ground, they had not detected civilian presence beforehand, when in fact civilians were in that particular place. And that to me was quite telling because, you know, a major part of the military's own process in targeting, you know, there are two parts of that. There's positive identification of the enemy and ensuring that, you know, who you're targeting is a legitimate target, which you can do, right? But the second part is really conducting a pattern of life, understanding what civilians may be there and whether or not, you know, they might be impacted by the strike activity that they're trying to carry out or that they would like to carry out. And so when you have such a high rate of failing to detect the presence of civilians, you're really going to be unable to accurately predict how many civilians are going to be killed or injured. And thus this idea that what we're doing is proportional, right? That the anticipated military advantage gained is not, you know, is higher than the cost of life, that there is some kind of proportionality to this, goes out the window.
I'd like to add another voice to the conversation now. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Phelps is the author of On Killing Remotely, The Psychology of Killing with Drones. He's the former commander of a drone squadron with the Marines. Wayne, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Wayne, as a former commander of a drone squad, what's your reaction to Osmond's reporting?
Yeah, so I think that Osmond's reporting is very powerful. You know, the military and the press we're eternally linked through the First Amendment of the Constitution, right? The military swears an oath to support and defend the Constitution, which gives, you know, the press, the freedom of press to report on those things, which ultimately provides us a feedback loop that makes us better, assuming that we take on board all of the things that are in the reports. And that's the pursuit, right? That we want to have a cleaner war without civilian casualties.
Now, we've heard about the underreported civilian death toll of U.S. airstrikes. And again, you ran a drone squadron specifically. In your experience, what are some of the benefits of drone warfare?
Well, drones allow you to have persistence over a target area. So there's no rush, or there should be no rush to a strike because of the long endurance of the platforms, plus the high definition of the cameras really allows you to conduct that pattern of life, like Osmond was talking about. So you can determine the right time to strike. You can figure out the right place where you can mitigate collateral damage, or where you can strike a target where it's going to be free of any sort of civilians around there. I like to refer to that as tactical patience. When you're using manned platforms, sometimes you have a limited window of opportunity in order to strike that platform because of their limited time on station. However, when you're, you know, employing a drone, you can have that tactical patience.
Now, Osmond, according to your reporting, American forces carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan between 2015 and 2020. And I want to focus in on the military use of drones for a moment, because it goes back much further than that. Can you walk us through some of that history?
Sure. So, you know, the use of drones has been prevalent. I think the first U.S. drone strike was in, you know, for the purposes of targeting, lethally targeting someone, was back in 2001. And actually, that airstrike killed an American named Kamal Dervish, and that was in Yemen. And, you know, so this use extends back many years. And, you know, before we started arming drones, they were used for surveillance purposes. They've been expanded in that use. Now they can be used for both surveillance and for weapons deployment. But you know, certainly I think Lieutenant Colonel Phelps can speak better to some of the intricacies of that. But precision-guided munitions are also something that the military tested over many years, that far, as far back as Vietnam, we're trying to use different kinds of precision-guided weapons. And there have been innovations in that over time, to the point where, you know, at one point it may have been laser guided and GPS guided, that now, you know, we have the ability to follow something despite bad weather patterns. So the precision of the weaponry, the kind of technologies that have developed, have really advanced from what we had been using in the past. And drones in particular, I think, are certainly weapons of choice in particular places. But when you're conducting a really heavy bombing campaign, for example, in Iraq and Syria and the war against ISIS, or in Afghanistan, you know, the pace of airstrikes in 2019 was greater than any other year previously recorded of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. What you wind up having is maybe there are drones involved conducting surveillance, but in reality, a lot of these strikes are happening from all different kinds of aircraft.
Wayne, what process did you go through in determining whether to carry out a drone strike?
Usually those decisions are made external to the drone crew itself. There's either a ground force commander or an air controller on the ground who is calling for assistance, and they're making the decision that something is a valid military target, and they're calling in an asset to strike a target, such as a drone or, you know, a manned platform. So usually it's an external organization that is doing that work for the drone crew and saying, this is your legitimate target.
I want to turn now to a conversation I had with Christopher Aaron. He's a former intelligence analyst for the CIA's drone program. Starting in 2006, he reviewed videos from drones and shared intelligence analysis with other units. He served 2 6-month deployments to Afghanistan in 2006 and 2008. And he began by telling me a memory that stands out from his time on the job.
I was working on the program when we took action against Abu al-Zarqawi, who at the time in 2006 was second in command behind Osama bin Laden. And there came a time where we took action on the target through a series of missile strikes. And when it was learned that we had indeed successfully killed al-Zarqawi, there was a sense of celebration in the room. There was, you know, people giving high fives, cheers, celebrations all around, as if when you kill an individual like that, it's a done deal, that the war is now moving in our favor. We are making progress towards stopping the terrorists or the extremists, and that chapter of the war is done. And so what I saw myself was after the celebration, the next day, we saw three coffins being carried through the streets, not just one coffin. And that's an incident that really struck me as to, are we actually conducting these wars in a way that is leading to more security and more peace around the world? Or is this, in fact, a self-perpetuating type of warfare that we're engaged in?
What conclusions have you come to about the effectiveness of U.S. military drone use, and especially as someone who had a front seat view?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that based on my experience, again, I can only talk to my experience. What I observed is that the strategy of dropping bombs and missiles on individuals, whether or not those individuals are legitimate terrorists or extremists, the strategy of pinpointing them with these missiles does not result in increased security nor increased peace, whether in Afghanistan or around the world. What I saw is that the strategy that we had been implementing was resulting in more suicide attacks on the base, more loss of life on both sides of the conflict, U.S., NATO life, as well as both legitimate targets and innocent civilians on the Afghani side. And to make matters worse, we were losing control of vast areas of Afghanistan that in 2006 we had control of. The entire southern region of the country is a state called, a province called Kandahar. We had lost control of Kandahar between 2006 and 2009 through this strategy.
What effect did your work as a drone operator have on you mentally, physically, in both the short and long term?
I suffered tremendously in the years after my return. It took me about 5 years to really get my life turned around again after I returned in 2009. The first couple of years were physiological health issues that I suffered from, a combination of the stress of the long shifts, the stress of the knowledge of taking life, making those decisions. A host of factors that are involved in simply being overseas in a war zone. I felt at 29 years old like I was physiologically perhaps 69 years old. It took me about 2 years to recover from those physiological ailments. And after that, that then clears the way to work on the psychological, the mental toll that that type of work took. And I just want to state for the record, of course, what I went through in my recovery is nothing like some of the innocent casualties had to suffer from in Afghanistan. So I want to acknowledge that. I have apologized on air several times to the people of Afghanistan. However, it's just to say that my experience, of course, doesn't compare to what they have had to go through. That said, us in the drone program as drone operators, and it's not just myself, I am in touch with a number of other individuals who I formerly worked with, there is a sense of moral regret. And this implements in certain ways. For me, the number one way that it manifested was in my dreams, where I had a recurring dream for a number of years where I was forced to sit in a chair and my eyeballs were held open almost with tape. And I was forced to watch some of the most gruesome torture scenes of human life that one can possibly fathom. And it was almost as if in my subconscious, it was saying to me, hey, You recovered from the physical. Now you thought you were going to be behind a screen. Now sit here and watch what you participated in.
When you were in the program, how much concern was there for civilian deaths that resulted from drone airstrikes?
Very little, not none. I certainly had some colleagues who, in our private discussions, when we'd be taking a lunch break or in between missions, would voice their concerns. However, generally speaking, there was the attitude that this is simply part of war. This is a necessary evil, if you will, and so we must carry on.
Were there any accountability measures in place if civilians were killed as a result of failed intelligence or mistakes that were made?
No, not that I saw.
You're one of only a handful of former drone operators who have spoken out publicly against their use. Why does it feel important for you to do this?
I reached a point where I said I can either look back at my life and say that I participated in some atrocities that I do not agree with and just let that stay with me, or I can try to do perhaps one good thing with this throughout the remainder of my life. And that's why I've chosen to do what I'm doing. I hope that even though I don't have the full picture, no one within the program has the full picture because it's entirely compartmentalized. That said, all I can do is speak about my experience, and if I'm able to change one heart or one mind, so perhaps we pursue a different strategy in dealing with extremists around the world, if I'm able to do that, then that is something that I would like to do.
That was my conversation with Christopher Aaron. He's a former intelligence analyst for the CIA's drone program. He served 2 6-month deployments to Afghanistan in 2006 and 2008. Remember to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code 1A. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to the conversation about drones and other airstrikes. Wayne, you interviewed more than 50 people who have been involved in drone operations for your book, and more than one described a type of intimacy they developed with the people they were targeting on the ground. Explain a bit more about where that feeling comes from and how it affects the people you interviewed.
Yeah, so a lot of the people that I interviewed, particularly the intelligence analysts, said that they were watching a target for hours, days, weeks, months, sometimes even years. And as they were developing this pattern of life and determining the right time and place for a strike, and what they realized was that they were developing this one-sided intimacy with this target. And that's because they were really recognizing the humanity of that individual. They were seeing that person doing normal things that you would do as a human, you know, going to the store, picking your children up from school, playing soccer in your backyard, and things like that. And they were also witnessing some of the nefarious actions that they were doing, the reasons why they were watching them in the first place. I interviewed one analyst who said that he was a father, and he was watching this target for a period of about 6 months. And he watched this father take his children, you know, to school every day and pick them up and hang out with his kids. And he said he knew that this guy was a good father. And then when it came time to strike that target, he said it was really difficult for him because he had developed this intimacy with that target.
Well, last week, the Pentagon announced it wouldn't discipline anyone involved in an August drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians. You said there isn't usually any accountability when drones kill civilians. Is there any effort to provide funding for ongoing medical care? Because there are also people who are severely injured.
So Congress for the last 5-6 years has authorized millions of dollars for what are known as condolence payments to individuals who have been injured or killed or suffered some kind of loss from U.S. combat operations in Iraq, Syria, and then Afghanistan as well. But despite that money being authorized and available for use by the U.S. military, they have made very few payments. You know, the very first payment offer they made for a civilian death or injury in the anti-ISIS air war was actually to the subject of a previous investigation of mine, a man named Bassem Razo. And one thing to know is that these payment offers can be quite paltry in the eyes of people who value human life. You know, they're often capped at $2,000 or $2,500 for a death. And Bassem Razo, this Iraqi man who was targeted, whose family was targeted in this strike, you know, whose daughter was killed, whose wife was killed, whose brother was killed, whose nephew was killed, was offered around $15,000 in the first payment offer of the anti-ISIS air war. And this offer was made in 2017. In the time since, in Iraq and Syria, they've made less than a dozen payments. In Afghanistan, the military has reported higher numbers of payments, but it's something that there's not a lot of transparency around. It's the subject of an ongoing legal battle that I have with the Department of Defense and other agencies who have these records. But essentially, you know, very few people are being provided payments, and one reason for that is that we don't have the same mechanisms that we used to back in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan of the aughts, right? Because we don't have soldiers on the ground in the same capacity who would have been distributing that money, who would have been assessing claims. We don't have that same infrastructure, and I think that's part of the reason why the military doesn't make these payments. I think they also, in their minds, think that those payments should come from their governments, like the government of Iraq or the government of Afghanistan, as opposed to directly from the United States. And in addition to that, you know, I think it's really, I want to get back to just even the amount being offered, because if you have a debilitating injury, like this young boy I met, whose name was Hassan, who was playing outside a high value individual, like at the home of a high value individual, an ISIS recruiter named Neil Prakash. You know, Hassan had been outside that home playing, and when this airstrike hit, and he was deeply injured. He has shrapnel in his spinal cord. I looked at the X-rays. He's confined to a wheelchair, but it's not quite a proper wheelchair. It's something his family can barely afford. Despite having concluded that, you know, this targeting of Neil Prakash had killed 4 civilians in the military's own records, they've never made a payment offer to that family or to the families of others who were injured or killed in that strike. And one other thing to know about that is that Neil Prakash, this man who in the records is confirmed as having been killed, showed up not long after that at the Turkish-Syria border trying to cross. He was alive and well. And, you know, a lot of the civilians who were impacted are still struggling to pay the most basic medical bills.
Wayne, how much accountability do you think there should be? As you've described the decision-making process, you have the people who are actually pushing the button, but the intelligence side of this is happening somewhere else. So how much accountability should there be, and what do you think it should look like?
Yeah, I think, you know, Osmond had some great points in her articles where she listed 9 things that are root causes of why these strikes go wrong. And the majority of those were misidentification of targets, you know, not identifying that there was civilians in the target area. So the majority of them had to do with the intelligence side of the strike process, or the front side that would actually authorize the strike. So when it comes to accountability, I think there needs to be an investigation of each one of those incidents where there's civilian casualties to determine, how did we get it wrong? How did we authorize a strike where there was significant collateral damage? Discipline is another issue, though. I think we tend to associate accountability with disciplinary actions, and I don't think that's going to be the case. People in the military get disciplined when they violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice or the Rules of Engagement or international humanitarian law, when they willfully violate those things. In these strikes, I don't think there's incidents where people are willfully conducting a strike knowing that there's going to be civilian casualties. If there are, it's determined at a certain level, it's authorized at a certain level that says that this is of significant enough military value that it's proportionate enough to the amount of civilian casualties that will occur. And that doesn't occur at the drone crew level. It usually is elevated up the chain of command depending on how high of a collateral damage estimate will occur.
Wayne, what is your opinion on how the U.S. military should be using drones, if at all?
Well, I think they should be part of an integrated force as opposed to a standalone force. There are theorists about air power that think that we can win conflicts through air power alone, and this is nothing new. Although it feels like it's new, it goes back to World War II and even beyond, really. So when you think that you can win a war solely through air power and not putting your own troops on the ground in harm's way, there are things that are going to be limitations. Operation Allied Force is a prime example. And that was even before the use of drones came about, right? We executed that entire conflict through the use of air power. The initial stages of Desert Storm was the same way. So drones are not the genesis for the American way of fighting through the use of just air power. It's just another tool that's been added to the arsenal. In fact, I think it's probably a good tool for the arsenal because it gives you endurance, precision, and tactical patience.
Osmond, very briefly, where does your reporting go from here?
I've spent a lot of time trying to understand, what kind of accountability mechanisms there are and, what might come out of this. What I hope certainly is a better understanding of these ground realities, is of the people who've experienced this and understanding that firsthand.
That's Osmit Khan, an investigative reporter for New York Times Magazine. She's currently writing a book about America's air wars. Also with us, Wayne Phelps, a retired lieutenant colonel with the Marine Corps and author of On Killing Remotely, The Psychology of Killing with Drones. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Avery J.C. Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.